Isaiah, the heart and holiness of God. The subject for today's class will be fruits worthy of repentance.
Our topic today, and I suspect it will spill into the next day's session, could really be subtitled Steps Toward Conversion. Now that sounds very New Testament in its phrasing, but perhaps we have begun to realize through our studies this week, from John's work in Samson and from Brother John's work on the emblems, that so much of the new covenant, as it's described in the New Testament, is deeply rooted, in fact, in the old revelation of the Old Testament. Really, old is a misnomer. Much of what is revealed in what we call the Old Testament is part and parcel of the gospel. So much so that the Apostle Paul could talk about the gospel that was preached unto Abraham. The transition that we sometimes perceive between Old and New Testament is often very artificial. I think the more that we pursue our Bible studies, the more we realize that that great gap between Old and New Testament can really be dissolved considerably. Much of the gospel of the New Testament is illuminated by what is understood in the Old. So, in a book referred to by Jesus on several occasions as a book which proclaims the mercy of God, which the scribes and the Pharisees fail to understand, in a book which has some relation to the Lord's ministry as he looked for the ripe fig in Israel, looking for spiritual fruits, we shouldn't be surprised to find a number of what we might call New Testament teachings in this Old Testament book. It is very New Testament from beginning to end. And all that we've said about the wonderful theme of the marriage of the bride to her husband, again, is what we perceive as being a New Testament emphasis. But of course, here it is in Hosea. Steps towards conversion. First, in Hosea, it's possible to identify the theme of resurrection and restoration. That theme is very closely connected to the emphasis in Hosea of coming out of Egypt. We're going to comment on both of those right now. It shouldn't be surprising in the book of Hosea to discover the theme of resurrection and restoration. That is, if we ask ourselves, what chapter in the New Testament gives us the greatest amount of treatment to the concept of resurrection? Let your mind reflect for a moment. Where would we go for a detailed consideration of the resurrection? 1 Corinthians 15. Where in 1 Corinthians 15 do we find any reference to Hosea? It's towards the end. Have you ever discovered at the end of 1 Corinthians 15, part of a hymn that we sing comes right out of Hosea? We're going to comment on that in greater detail tomorrow when we deal with "Of whom speaketh the prophet thus?" At the end of 1 Corinthians 15, reference to the sting of death comes right out of a section from Hosea. So that in one of the most detailed chapters in the entire New Testament, dealing with the importance, the centrality of the doctrine of resurrection, Paul draws through the Spirit's guidance from the book of Hosea and takes a whole section out of Hosea as being the cornerstone for one of his final comments on the importance of resurrection, victory over sin and death. We'll deal with that, as we said, in greater detail tomorrow. So that when we go to the prophecy of Hosea and suggest that there is a theme running through that prophecy that could be described as the theme of resurrection and restoration, we're not forcing something on the prophecy which the New Testament writers themselves did not see through the Spirit's guidance. Our theme of resurrection and restoration could really begin in kind of an incidental way in Hosea 1 verse 10. It's first hinted at there in order in the prophecy, and it is only a hint. Hosea chapter 1 verse 10. Yet in contrast to the rather negative statements of verses 4 to 8. Verse 9 reads, "Then said God, call his name Lo-Ami, for ye are not my people, and I will not be your God." Verse 10, "Yet," here's the transition of thought, "yet the number of the children of Israel shall be as the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured nor numbered. And it shall come to pass that in the place where it was said unto them, ye are not my people, there it shall be said unto them, ye are the sons of the living God." The anticipation of a reversal in the future. Despite what they were not, this is what they will finally become in the latter days. A hint to the nation's restoration and their resurrection to a new life and a new relationship with God. The words there in verse 10 are rather an echo of the incident with Balaam and Balak. Israel is blessed, as in the Numbers account with Balaam and Balak. Israel is blessed in the very place where curses were once evoked. Now consider that carefully, because this kind of twist in thought is going to be found a number of times this morning. In the place where curses were evoked, in that very place blessings are found. As with Balaam and Balak, so here in Hosea 1 verse 10, "In the place where it was said unto them, you are not my people, there it will be said unto them," as a reversal, "you are my people." A resurrection, a reason for hope in the midst of a dismal condition at the time of Hosea. Hosea chapter 1 verse 4, now for attention. This name Jezreel, it has both of these aspects tied in. A negative and a positive association with one name. As verse 10 has a negative and a positive association, in the place where it was said unto them thus and so, there it shall be said unto them positively, you are a people. In the name Jezreel, the same kind of thought combines two elements, negative and positive. For, when he's told, verse 4, "The Lord said unto him, call his name Jezreel, for yet a little while, and I will avenge the blood of Jezreel upon the place of the house of Jehu," there is something negative or derogatory attached to that name Jezreel. And yet, if we pursue through the prophecy, at the end of this chapter, we are told, verse 11, last phrase, "For," speaking of the future, "great shall be the day of Jezreel." A positive and a negative association now with the very name Jezreel. Would you just, if you have them available, turn to the yellow page on the notes. I haven't looked at them for several days. Hopefully now the diagram means a little more to us. It serves to explain this positive and negative application to the name Jezreel. The prophet Hosea represents God in a marriage relationship. We see that in the diagram. Gomer was meant to portray, as the bride, Israel. We are told in Hosea 1 verse 4 that the first child born would be called Jezreel. Now, notice in Hosea 1 verse 4 the construction of the sentence as it stresses that she bare him, Hosea, a son. She bare him a son. So that was a legitimate son born to the two parties. When we come to Lo-Ami and Lo-Ruhamah in verse 6 and 9 of chapter 1, the phrase "bear him a daughter" or "bear him a son" is absent. I believe that's significant. In a rather subtle way, it suggests, both with the absence of that phrase, "bearing him a son or daughter," and also the fact that both of the other children have derogatory names that can't be construed any other way, there is a suggestion that the last two children were illegitimate. And they were the ones that were the children of whoredoms, born out of wedlock in the enacted parable between Hosea and his wife. The first son being legitimate, the latter two children, most likely illegitimate, born out of wedlock and not Hosea's. And hence, when we are told in verse 2, take unto thee a wife of whoredoms and children of whoredoms, we have at least two of them being fulfilled in Hosea's own experience. The positive and the negative aspect hinted at with Jezreel. The very name Jezreel, brothers and sisters, in the original, betrays this positive and negative sense. For literally, Jezreel, and it's shown on your yellow sheet, can mean from the Hebrew, God sows, and you think of the broadcast method of sowing, where the sower, as in the parable of the sower, would dip into his pouch, which would contain the kernels, and the kernels would be spread broadcast. That's a negative kind of application to God's sowing, scattering in other words. Or it could be in the positive sense of God planting for the purpose of building and the purpose of growth and development. So in the Hebrew word itself, and in its use in this first chapter, there is a good and there is a bad or negative association with the name. All of which has within it a reason for hope. Although God will scatter, there is reason to hope that he will sow in a positive sense. Although the name Jezreel is associated with God's displeasure, great shall be the day of Jezreel in the future. In the place that was said unto them, you are not my people, Jezreel, there it will be said unto them, you are my people. The bringing together of those two thoughts in contrast to each other, rather unique in many ways to this prophecy. All of it has within it the kernel of restoration and hope, hinted at. But it is not developed in any detail. We are told negatively here, taking the scattering and the derogatory sense of Jezreel, that there was bloodshed associated with Jezreel. We can see that in verse 4. Call his name Jezreel for yet a little while, and I will avenge, or seek justice, on the blood of Jezreel. Now, what was there in Israel's past that had such negative associations with Jezreel? First, Jezreel was the location of Naboth's vineyard. It was there that the man was put to death and his inheritance seized. It was in Jezreel that Joram died of his sore wounds. It was in Jezreel that Ahaziah was mortally smitten. It was in Jezreel that Jezebel finally met her gruesome fate. And it was in Jezreel where we receive the expression in the Kings, all that remained of the house of Ahab did Jehu slaughter. And there it was, in Jezreel. The place had many negative associations, associated mostly with rebellion and bloodshed. And yet, although the stains were red like crimson, that very place will be associated with cleansing and a reason for hope. Though the place was stained with blood, red as crimson, it would be finally associated with something that was white and clean. In the words of Isaiah, though your sins be as scarlet or crimson, they shall be white as wool or white as snow. Again, this juxtaposition of something positive and negative. In the midst of Israel's dilemma, in the midst of their despair, there would be a ray for hope, a reason for a positive hope in the God they worship. Now we notice, as we go through the prophecy of Hosea, how the concept of sowing has this twofold aspect, broadcast and the idea of positively growing. Now look at the negative first. Chapter 4 of Hosea, as we pursue this. Hosea 4, verse 19. The King James reads there, the wind hath bound her up in her wings, and they shall be ashamed because of their sacrifices. Now in the New International, just as an example, the force is grasped in the translation a little better. The NIV says, a whirlwind will sweep them away. And the whirlwind is very much associated in a context of sowing with the blowing away of the chaff. It has the scattering aspect of Jezreel in thought. Other examples, chapter 8 of Hosea, bringing together many of these thoughts, which gives the prophecy just a little more cohesion than what appears at first when we read this second part of the book. Chapter 8, verse 7. See how it's related to the chapter about the whirlwind. Hosea 8, verse 7. For they have sown the wind. They've scattered themselves by their actions. They shall reap the whirlwind. It hath no stock. The bud shall yield no meal. If so be it yield, the strangers shall swallow it up. There's Jezreel. Being scattered broadcast, spread to the whirlwind, taken away by their own foolishness. But within the prophecy, chapter 10, verse 12, there are positive associations with Jezreel, or with sowing. Here in chapter 10, it comes out clearest in verse 12. The context is an appeal to Ephraim, verse 11. 12 reads, "Sow to yourselves in righteousness, reap in mercy. Break up your fellow ground, for it is time to seek the Lord, till he come and rain righteousness upon you." Notice the New Testament teaching here, that righteousness is not of their own, it comes from God. It is God that rains righteousness upon them. Hence, the point in Jeremiah, "The Lord our righteousness," because he, God, rains righteousness upon the nation and provides, or helps to provide, the fertile conditions necessary for resurrection and restoration. In the dry ground of Israel, the Lord will help in the latter days to break up that soil. He will rain righteousness upon them so that they can sow to themselves in righteousness and reap God's merciful, abundant blessings. God then participating in the process that is positive. A reason to understand in greater detail all the thought behind Matthew 13 with the parable of the sower. The Lord helps to bless the conditions when he sees a responsive heart. The ground can be broken up, the heart can be circumcised from within, and the Lord can help to rain righteousness upon that dry, barren soil, that baked, charred piece of bread that we looked at earlier on, that impenetrable, baked, hot oven. All of those conditions can be altered. In their distress, in their foolishness, the conditions can be reversed, subject to God's mercy. He will rain righteousness upon them, and they will bear the fruits of the Spirit. God participating at every stage in the process. There are other associations in Scripture that make this positive. This passage in verse 12, brothers and sisters, of Hosea 10, is in fact quoted in Jeremiah. There's a lot of parallels between Jeremiah and Hosea. We've already mentioned that Jeremiah 3 and 4 are a kind of mini-Hosea, being later to Hosea. I'll just flip over then to Jeremiah 31 as a companion prophecy, and see how this aspect of sowing is picked up in Jeremiah's message. Jeremiah 31, verse 27 as an example. And see how it echoes Hosea chapter 1. Jeremiah 31, verse 27. Verse 27, "Behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that I will sow the house of Israel." Notice that. "I will sow the house of Israel and the house of Judah with the seed of man and with the seed of beast. And it shall come to pass that like as I have," the negative, "watched over them to pluck up and to break down and to throw down," the scattering aspect of Jezreel, "and to destroy and to afflict," now positively, "so I will watch over them to build and to plant, saith the Lord." We see also in Jeremiah 31 further references that are positive. Look at verse 37. "Thus saith the Lord, if heaven above can be measured and the foundations of the earth searched out beneath, I will also cast off all the seed of Israel for all that they have done, saith the Lord." In other words, If those things can be done away, then I will cast them off forever. The implication being, those things will never be finally terminated, and neither will my care for Israel be terminated. I have cast them off, but not forever. I have scattered them, but I will sow them again to myself. The overlapping thoughts of the two prophets give us then the total picture. And a lot of that is behind the parable of the sower in Matthew 13. Back to Hosea, chapter 2 now. We receive from the prophet now, as we go out of chapter 1, a further development on this theme of resurrection and restoration, which again helps us to appreciate why Hosea especially was chosen by Paul as a wonderful context for a doctrine on resurrection. All right, chapter 2 of Hosea, verse 7. This time it's from the woman, from Israel herself. And she shall, speaking of the future, follow after her lovers, but shall not overtake them. And she shall seek them and shall not find them. Then shall she say, I will go and return to my first husband, for then was it better with me than now. Here is a hint that the woman will finally come to her senses like the prodigal son. But unlike the prodigal son here, it is only a thought. Nothing in the context of chapter 2 suggests that she really does take the initiative. It is a thought. It is a realization that her former condition was better, like the prodigal son in the father's house, much better than the plight that she now faced. So once again, there's a small hint in the prophecy that there is reason for hope, that there will be a restoration, that the woman will reconsider. But it doesn't really develop in any great detail here in chapter 2. That seems to be reserved now for the further revelation in the prophecy. Have you ever noticed, as you go through Hosea in your readings, how many times reference is made to Egypt? How many are there? 13 times in total, all through the prophecy. Most of the references being found between Hosea chapters 11 and 12. What's being said? In a book used in the New Testament to support the concept of resurrection and restoration, in a book quoted by Jesus to pinpoint the importance of mercy and not sacrifice, we find all the way through it a kind of unifying thread, and it's hard to find unifying threads in Hosea, one of them being this constant reference 13 times to Egypt. Is it any wonder, then, that it is from Hosea that the Gospel of Matthew refers when Jesus comes out with Joseph and Mary, out of Egypt have I called my son? 13 times that place is referred to in the context of that prophecy. So the statement used in the Gospel record is set in a context that has a lot of emphasis on Egypt. But why not? The coming out of Egypt was the main symbol in the Old Testament for restoration nationally. The coming out of Egypt was the main symbol of a hope for a new life and a new start. Is it not so in the New Testament? Does not Paul in Corinthians refer back to the baptism of the nation that were baptized in the Red Sea into Moses? And that the coming out of Egypt there is also an adequate symbol of the Christian who has come through the waters of baptism, baptized into Christ, starting a new way of life, and the hope of resurrection and restoration, and the hope of receiving the inheritance later on, after the wilderness journey. All of those thoughts in Hosea mesh together and provide a tremendous tie-in with many Old Testament and New Testament statements. In fact, right here in Hosea 2, let's go back to the text. Verse 14, there is the hint of the future having a kind of second Exodus pattern for the faithful. A second Exodus type of pattern. Look at verse 14. Therefore, again the future, behold, I will allure her, Israel, and bring her into the wilderness, and speak comfortably unto her. Didn't God do that in the past, literally, with the nation? Will he not do it also in the future? Does he not also do it with us? Do we not come out of the world and be separate? Do we not, like Moses, described in Hebrews 11, forsake the treasures of Egypt and come out
to be strangers and pilgrims, looking for a city which hath foundations, not the corruptibility of Egypt? Do we not respond to the Lord's call, and does he not speak comfortably to our hearts when we receive an understanding of the good news and respond at baptism? Verse 15, I will give her, future, her vineyards from thence, those that I have destroyed and taken away, and the valley of Achor for a door of hope, and she shall sing there as in the days of her youth, and as in the day when she came up out of the land of Egypt. Second type of Exodus in the future. The remembrance of Achor, back to the time of Joshua when he crossed at Gilgal, and the nation received a plague because of the sin of Achan, who hid a Babylonian garment and a wedge of gold under his tent. All of that was after coming out of the wilderness, after coming out of Egypt. Now we see how this is developed in a little more detail by the contemporary prophet Isaiah, who in his ministry, contemporary with Hosea, is overlapping a lot of these statements. Just hold your hand here in Hosea 2. Take a peek at Isaiah chapter 11. Being the early part of Isaiah's ministry, this certainly must have been said very close to the time that these thoughts are expressed in Hosea 2. It's good to keep our mind kind of divided between these two prophets and see how they complement. Again, speaking of the future and a second Exodus. Isaiah chapter 11, verse 10. In that day, there shall be a root of Jesse, which shall stand for an ensign of the people. To it the Gentiles shall seek, and his rest shall be glorious. And it shall come to pass in that day that the Lord shall set his hand again the second time to recover the remnant of his people, which shall be left from Assyria, and from Egypt, and from Pathros, and from Cush, and from Elam, and from Shinar, which is Babylon, and from Hamath, and from the islands of the sea. And he shall set up an ensign for the nations, and shall assemble the outcasts of Israel, and gather together the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth. Now Ephraim is mentioned, like in Hosea. And the envy also of Ephraim shall depart, and the adversaries of Judah shall be cut off. Ephraim shall not envy Judah, Judah shall not vex Ephraim. We go down to verse 15. The Lord shall utterly destroy the tongue of the Egyptian sea, and with his mighty wind shall he shake his hand over the river, and shall smite it in the seven streams, and men shall go over dryshod. A second Exodus. And there shall be a highway for the remnant of his people, which shall be left from Assyria. Like as it was to Israel in the day that he came up out of the land of Egypt. Isaiah is saying that. Hosea is saying what he is saying here in chapter 2. Reference to the valley of Achor. As in the day when she came up out of the land of Egypt. Two thoughts, overlapping. All complementing each other in this wonderful theme for hope. Positive conviction for Israel that God intends to resurrect and restore them in his mercy. We pursue this a little further. Why is it in Hosea that the northern tribes are represented, brothers and sisters, by the term Ephraim? Why is that? Why should Ephraim be the representative name for the northern 10 tribes? Let's look at Hosea chapter 4. This is really an intriguing tie-in with the theme about Egypt, mentioned some 13 times. We turn to chapter 4 of Hosea, verse 17. You might want to just make a note to yourself in the margin here that this mention of Ephraim here in verse 17 is the first time out of a total of 37 references to Ephraim in the prophecy alone. That's the first of 37 references to Ephraim. That's an enormous number of references in such a short prophecy. To underscore the frequency of that reference, let's compare a bigger prophecy. How many times, for example, is Ephraim mentioned in Isaiah? 66 chapters, much larger than Hosea. You know, Ephraim is only mentioned 13 times in the total book of Isaiah, who, as we know, is a contemporary with this prophet Hosea. 13 times in Isaiah, and 37 times within this little prophecy of Hosea. Something's being stressed. Does it relate in any way, for example, to the theme of Egypt? It does. That might seem at first to be a rather unlikely correlation, but it does relate. Think of the past. First, Ephraim's history. Ephraim, we know, once housed the Ark of God. That is, the tribe of Ephraim did, because Shiloh, the place of the Ark for a long time, was in Ephraim. And that marked a privileged position, a kind of status symbol, for the tribe of Ephraim on behalf of the Northern Confederacy. When David returned the Ark to Zion, it really marked a blow to Ephraim's pride, for she lost the housing of the Ark of God. And I don't think Ephraim ever forgot that. There are insinuations in this prophecy and some of the other minor prophets that Ephraim never ever accepted that removal of the Ark by David. And that it was a housing grudge down through Ephraim's history and a real push against their pride. I don't think many of them ever accepted that on David's behalf. Later, however, Ephraim had other reason to be proud in the wrong way. Because it was within Ephraim that Jeroboam built his capital city of Shechem, which was the capital in Mount Ephraim. Now, all of those facts about Ephraim's pride are sort of in a roundabout way mentioned in Hosea, which we haven't got time to look at. The proud man, or the proud tribe from the past history. A grudge being harbored for the lack of status by David's removal of the ark. Those facts only lie on the surface. The stress on Ephraim and the stress on Egypt. Let's ask a question which will help focus our attention on this. What do you recall, brothers and sisters, about the birth of the 12 tribes or the 12 sons of Israel? They were all born to Jacob, were they not? Before they went into Egypt with Joseph? Is that correct? No, it's not. Let's go back to Genesis 46. Not all the sons of Joseph, or rather, not all the sons of Jacob, were born outside of Egypt. Not all of them came down with Jacob. Genesis chapter 46, an important bit of history behind Ephraim. Here in the story of Joseph, we discover in chapter 46, the sons are listed for us. Verse 18, the sons of Rachel are mentioned, verse 19 of Genesis 46, Joseph and Benjamin being stressed. Then verse 20, and unto Joseph in the land of Egypt were born Manasseh and Ephraim, which Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, bare unto him. So Ephraim had its roots in Egypt, in a way that was untypical of any of the other sons of Jacob except for Manasseh. Being born, and therefore replacing Joseph's name in the 12 tribal lots, both Ephraim and Manasseh were literally born and had their historical roots in the land of Egypt. Now, that is kind of an irony as you go back to Hosea, with the constant reference to Egypt being the place where they've been polluted. With the call all the way through Hosea, come out of her, my son, come out of her, my son, come out. I have called my son out of Egypt. That had particular point to Ephraim, mentioned 37 times in the prophecy. Because Ephraim's historical roots were attached to Egypt, with Manasseh, more than any of the other tribes. And when the nation to the north returned to idolatrous worship, which aped the worship of Egypt, she was going right back to the place of her very birth to Joseph. She had that kind of historical heritage deeply rooted in her past. So that the emphasis of one word going through the prophecy is meant to dovetail and be ironic in its references to the other, Ephraim and Egypt. But you know, the irony doesn't end there. Ephraim literally means in the Hebrew, double fruitfulness. Double fruitfulness. And there's a kind of play on that in Hosea chapter 9, for example. double fruitfulness? Well, what has been the result at Hosea's time to Ephraim? Is she doubly fruitful? Chapter 9. Verse 11. As for Ephraim, double fruitfulness, their glory shall fly away like a bird. From the birth, and from the womb, and from the conception. Will she be doubly fruitful? She will not. She will be doubly barren, is the implication. Biting irony in the meaning of her name. Verse 16, notice how double fruitfulness is attended to again. Ephraim, verse 16, doubly fruitful, is smitten. Their root is dried up. They shall bear no fruit. God is putting the point graphically into the face of Ephraim. You've gone back to Egypt, to the source of your birth. You have forgotten me, your maker, and your husband. And as a result, I will doubly punish you and leave you barren and without children. And you will be barren in an agricultural sense, in verse 16. You will have no fruit, and I will strike the very root of your source. How could the nation miss the point, brothers and sisters? From me, Hosea 14, from me is thy fruit found, says the prophet in Hosea 14. Here, doubly fruitful, doubly barren, as it were, says Jesus in John 15, you are the branches, I am the vine. And Christ says, it would seem alluding to Hosea 14, yes, I am the branch, you are the branches, I am the vine, and your strength is in me, to paraphrase John 15. You must be attached and grafted into me in order to have the life source of strength. Says Jesus in John 15, you cannot bear fruit of yourself. An allusion perhaps to Hosea 14, of me is thy fruit found, all of which is a play in contrast on a nation or a tribe doubly fruitful by name, but barren by practice. But there's more here. Why this reference to birth and conception in regards to Ephraim's fruitfulness? Why this reference to the vine and to the root being dried up? Hold your hand there, and let's slip back to the blessings of Jacob, to the sons of Israel. Genesis chapter 49 illuminates this considerably. Chapter 49, verse 25. This is a beautiful illumination of the point made in the prophet. Because in speaking to Joseph, representative really of Ephraim and Manasseh, who is, of course, within the bowels, as it were, of Joseph, the blessing reads in verse 25, Genesis 49, even by the God of thy father, Joseph, who shall help thee, and by the Almighty, who shall bless thee with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that lieth under, blessings of the breasts and of the womb. As for Ephraim, says Hosea, their glory shall fly away like a bird from the birth and from the womb and from the conception. Not double fruitfulness, but a reversal of Jacob's blessings. Now further, Genesis 49, let's pursue this. Go back to verse 22. Joseph is a fruitful bough, verse 22, even a fruitful bough by a well whose branches run over the wall. Says Hosea, verse 16, chapter 9, Ephraim double fruitfulness is smitten, their root is dried up, they shall bear no fruit. A reversal of Jacob's blessings. How could Ephraim miss the point? From me is thy fruit found. Says Jesus, you cannot bear fruit of yourselves. New Testament doctrine in the Old Testament. Now, we could connect this to Psalm 80. I'll leave Psalm 80 with you and notice that there are at least two or three more links in Psalm 80 with the blessings here of Joseph, Ephraim, and Manasseh in Genesis 49 And furthermore, there are two or three links in Psalm 80 with Hosea's prophecy. The important one only we will mention. We go from Hosea 9, verse 16, in reference to the root drying up, to Hosea chapter 10, verse 1, which has to be in some way connected with Psalm 80. And we'll read both to you. Says Psalm 80, and I'm only going to read one part. Verse 8 of Psalm 80. Thou hast brought a vine out of Egypt, and hast cast out the heathen, as they did under Joshua, and planted it. Thou hast brought a vine out of Egypt, cast out the heathen, and planted it. And the context of Psalm 80 in verse 2 is Ephraim and Manasseh. Here, in chapter 10, verse 1, Israel, in contrast, is an empty vine. He bringeth forth fruit unto himself. Jesus' words in John 15, you cannot bear fruit of yourself. Here is the context of the Lord's quotation. In the context, with no chapters dividing, of the reference to Ephraim's curses. In verse 11, in verse 15, and in verse 16 of chapter 9. The whole context is relevant to John 15. And it is biting irony for Jesus to quote this. You cannot bear fruit of yourself, my disciples. Ephraim thought she would be doubly fruitful, and she thought she could bear fruit of herself, and she was barren. Her breasts dried, the child aborted, conception was stopped, their root was dried up, no fruit, no productivity. Yet, said God in Psalm 80, I have brought a vine out of Egypt. Ephraim, your association in the past was with Egypt. You've been brought out, and you have reversed the process by betraying me. If we were not convinced that Hosea has a bridging thought to the New Testament, that should be apparent to us this morning. Have you noticed in passing, as we close, the reference to Achor in chapter 2? Let's end in Isaiah 65, the contemporary prophet with Hosea, who also picks up a reference to Achor. Isaiah chapter 65. Here, like Jezreel, there is this double play on the significance of a location having both positive and negative remembrances. Isaiah 65, speaking of the future and the blessings of restoration and resurrection. Verse 7 of Isaiah 65. Your iniquities and the iniquities of your fathers together, saith the Lord, which have burned incense upon the mountains and blasphemed me upon the hills, therefore I will measure their former work into their bosom. Thus saith the Lord, as the new wine is found in the cluster, and one saith, destroy it not, for a blessing is in it, so will I do to my servants' sakes, for my servants' sakes, that I may not destroy them all. And I will bring forth a seed out of Jacob and out of Judah, an inheritor of my mountains, and mine elect shall inherit it, and my servant shall dwell there. And Sharon shall be as a fold of flocks, and the valley of Achor, a place where there was troubling, a place where there was apostasy and judgment in the past, will be a place for the herds to lie down in, for my people that have sought me. Brothers and sisters, we pick up that thought tomorrow and find how it will be that Israel will finally seek their God and find him and inherit the place of the sheep and find a place to lie down in a place that was once troubling, but then will be a place for hope.